Okay, we're ready to call our next case, Lopez v. Attorney General of the United States, appellate numbers 17-2146 and 17-3130. We'll hear from the petitioner.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. My name is Christopher Seskelly of Nationality Service Center, and along with my co-counsel, Joni Eaton, we are pro bono counsel for the petitioner in this matter, Renee Lopez Ramirez. I will be addressing the Fourth Amendment and jurisdictional issues in this matter, and my colleague, Mr. Eaton, will discuss how this case implicates the suspension clause, as well as a possible statutory remedy in this case. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That'll be granted.
This case is about whether the government is free to intentionally violate my client's Fourth Amendment rights in order to detain and deport him from the United States.
Counsel, let me ask you a factual question. We have two reinstatement orders here. The second one was issued, I believe, in June, and the motion to reopen was filed before then. The second one was June 8th. The motion to reopen was filed before that. Was the second one a ruling on the motion to reopen?
We are unclear of that at this time. The government hasn't made any representation regarding that. We would take the position that our motion to reopen was considered either a statement contesting the original reinstatement determination as a non-citizen subject to reinstatement is able to make under the regulation at 8 CFR 1241.8, or alternatively that our motion to reopen was considered properly a regulatory motion pursuant to 8 CFR 103.5.
And hasn't been acted upon.
No, we have not received any type of written decision regarding that motion.
And if that's the case, why didn't you just ask us to remand, get a ruling on that motion to reopen?
Because we believe that there are crucial factual issues that still need to be developed in this matter.
Well, couldn't it be developed on a motion to reopen where the issue is the egregiousness, what happened, Fourth Amendment, all of those things as to whether the trooper was pretextual, all of those things could be developed, wouldn't they?
And in fact, just to follow on, the government at page 16 of the brief say the agency could have considered that. So why didn't you just ask to go back there? Or maybe we should just go back there.
Yeah. We did have some communications with the government about our motion. Just there was a sort of a back and forth through a motion to amend the administrative record to include the regulatory motion that we've been referring to. But it seemed as if the government took no interest.
They want to stick with their position that night, if he didn't say, "I'll contest," he's out. He's out of luck.
Your Honor, it does seem that their position is that your sole administrative remedy in the reinstatement context is to bring whatever factual or legal challenges you have regarding the reinstatement process at the moment that that piece of paper is signed. And in our client's situation, that was the very night of his arrest.
Right. Do you know why a second reinstatement order was entered? It's been described as a superseding order. Do you know why the second order was entered?
It's unclear to us.
Do you know the status of, I know there's a collateral application being made as a derivative, I guess, of his spouse's application. Mm-hmm. I know that there's, according to your brief, there's a motion for reconsideration of the denial of that application. Do you know the status of that?
It remains pending at this time. I tried to follow up on that, but I haven't heard back from the Vermont Service Center of USCIS that adjudicates those petitions.
If there were a Fourth Amendment violation here, why is there not sufficient, say, attenuation to do away with the taint of the violation?
Well, their response brief, the government does raise the issue of attenuation, particularly with statements that our client made during the reasonable fear process,
right,
that is his right to avail himself of, sort of apart from the reinstatement process. But our position is that those statements were made in a way that is directly tied to the initial unlawful seizure and detention.
But for the fingerprints, none of this would have happened?
Yes, Your Honor.
But what about the fact that he was counseled at different stages, eventually was placed in withholding of removal, in order to get the benefit of withholding, obviously the condition precedent usually is, I concede removability. And he did that counseled. Weeks, almost months after the stop, why isn't that sufficient attenuation? And again, we're assuming for the purposes of discussion that there is a fact-finding that found a violation of the Fourth Amendment. Okay.
Those statements were made as part of a process that is really the last opportunity of a non-citizen who has an order reinstated against them to remain in the United States when they have a fear of returning to their country of origin. So I would contend that those statements were made in a rather coercive context where he had been detained from the initial encounter with the state police all the way up until the point that he made those statements in his asylum application.
What is your identity? Can you suppress your identity? And once they had his identity, they have a valid order of removal.
Your Honor, identity evidence in the case law is sometimes referred to in different ways. Pre-existing immigration file evidence and fingerprint information gathered as a result of an unlawful seizure can be suppressed.
You're saying the alien file could be suppressed?
There is authority.
In the Fifth Circuit?
In the case United States v. Bally, this court considered whether immigration file evidence could be suppressed. While declining to suppress it in that matter, the court made a finding that they were not dealing with an egregious violation of the Fourth Amendment.
So what happens? Let's play this out. Let's assume, well, your argument is egregious Fourth Amendment violation, suppression not only of what happened the night of the event, but his alien file in total. What's the remedy? What relief do you get from that? His status remains still undocumented. So what relief would you be asking?
With a valid order of removal.
Right. That's not, can't be challenged.
His immigration status would still be very precarious in this country. He would have an outstanding removal order, although an executed one. So perhaps not outstanding.
No, it's not. It's a valid order of removal. He came back in illegally, and so it's considered a valid order of removal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Even if the reinstatement gets thrown out because of a Fourth Amendment violation, it would be reinstated after the fact.
The government could do that perhaps if they found independent evidence of his alienage, but relying on the same evidence would not...
Are you saying his alien file is suppressed for all purposes in perpetuity?
I think that's a little bit beyond this matter. We contend that his alien file should be suppressed as far as the documentation that was in it the night that he was subject to the unlawful seizure.
Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong, but as a factual matter, it's the fingerprints that matter. Because when he came in, he had so many aliases, and they never would have found, if they didn't have the fingerprints, they wouldn't have found the prior removal order at all. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. In order to reinstate the order, they have to connect the non-citizen to the prior removal order.
And because of aliases and because his passport was such that he couldn't have done that. They couldn't have done that.
If we're acting on the assumption that the fingerprints could be suppressed, then yes.
That's what I'm saying. But so we get the fingerprints suppressed, and we get the reinstatement order nullified because of a Fourth Amendment violation. We slap IHS on the DHS, whatever, on the hand. And then he wins this victory. He's subject to a removal order. Is he not still? It may not have been reinstated, but they could reinstate him again.
Theoretically, they could possibly reinstate against him in the future, but our client would be able to walk free if this evidence was subject to suppression the next day.
Walk free because of no detention?
Yes.
Yes. So it's his detention pending removal right now that you're thinking he wins this, he gets out of detention, and they got to find him.
Perhaps. I think that's a little bit beyond my knowledge base how exactly Homeland Security sort of prioritizes the enforcement of the law.
But nothing undoes the fact that he's subject to a removal order while in this country, then even if the reinstatement would be nullified, there could be a further reinstatement.
And as he walks out the door, he could be taken into custody.
I think in that hypothetical, Judge Roth, because the evidence had been suppressed.
But they know who he is.
Yes, but I would contend that any immediate detention following suppression would undoubtedly be relying on similar evidence that was fruit of the poisonous tree from the unlawful seizure that we're talking about.
But then your argument is if he's taken into custody 1 minute after he's released or a year after he's released, you're saying it's all the fruit? Because then you're saying the alien file is suppressed in perpetuity.
I think undoubtedly there's a point at which it would become too attenuated.
So the attenuation for you is not when he's counseled in other proceedings. Your attenuation is he gets his custody status is removed from him and he's free. And if once he's free, if he's taken into custody, the process can, I'm sorry, he's released from custody, the process could restart?
I think that would be a factual question in a subsequent proceeding, whether there was an attenuation issue there or not. I think the closer we get to the original hypothetical suppression, the stronger argument there is that subsequent enforcement is fruit of a poisonous tree. And I would just like to say our client does have...
As he walks out the door, if they say, "Who are you?" And he says, "I am Isidoro Aguilar Lopez." Okay, you're subject to an order of removal. Come with us.
In that situation, Judge Roth, the new detention would be undoubtedly connected to the prior unlawful detention.
To them asking the question, "Who are you?"
And it would be his response to that, not anything before, unless he lies to who he is.
Yeah, he would be perhaps subject in that circumstance to a normal sort of enforcement for being an alien in the country without documentation.
With a valid order of removal.
I think given those facts, because the identity evidence that is undoubtedly not suppressible in terms of Supreme Court jurisprudence is his name and his date of birth, but they would have to establish his alienage through some other's evidence, unless he freely gave that up to him, gave that up to this enforcement agent. So they would need more than just his name if we had suppressed the prior evidence, because they wouldn't have in their possession untainted evidence of his alienage. And I would add that our client does have pending immigration relief that would potentially allow him to waive inadmissibility issues related to the prior removal order and subsequent
reentry. Are you talking about the application, derivative application for his spouse?
Yes. That's why this is not solely an academic exercise. There's actually relief available for our client at the end of the road here.
And but that relief is independent of this. You applied for that derivative that relief in 2016.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's got nothing to do with what happens with respect to this stop and in reinstatement of the removal order.
But apart from the visa application, our client's core rights under the Fourth Amendment, and just because he's...
And we're not denigrating them in our questioning. We're just trying to, since we don't have a lot of material, we're trying to assume what happens if you prevail on that point. And I think that's what Judge Roth was alluding to, is we still have a valid removal order. And I think that's where we were going. So We'll have you up on rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. My name is Jonah Eaton, and I am co-counsel for the petitioner. And I'm going to be addressing the suspension clause violation at issue in this case in light of this Court's very recent decision in Osorio Martinez versus Attorney General. And I believe I can also talk a little bit about what we believe is a possible statutory mechanism that might avoid the suspension clause issues.
If we were to send this back for a full hearing adjudication on the motion to reopen, would there be a suspension clause problem?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why?
Right now, because of the procedural posture of this case, Your Honor, an immediate remand would simply place it back in front of ICE. And ICE is not, this is an ICE officer sort of making an administrative decision. They do not have all the tools that either immigration judge or a district court judge would have in terms of developing a robust record.
But your adversary represents in its brief, had the petitioner submitted his application to DHS, the agency could have considered his evidence and at least weighed it against the DHS agent's account, et cetera, page 16 of their brief. So the government is saying there is a mechanism through the DHS, not even back to the IJ. So doesn't that, the question that Judge Rendell asked you is the very one I had. Don't we avoid the whole suspension clause problem because even the government concedes there's an avenue to be heard?
Well, I wanted to make one more sort of slight clarification about the fact that we have these two reinstatement orders. So again, just to review kind of the timeline here, there was the initial reinstatement order issued the night of his arrest. It must have been minutes before midnight. We dual characterized it as both either a motion to reopen, or to consider it as a contestation of a reinstatement of removal. After that came the second reinstatement. The reinstatement, even just the form they use on the reinstatement, is having considered all evidence on the record, everything submitted,
That's kind of boilerplate, though. The government opposed your ability to file that motion. They said he waived all rights that night. But there should be some kind of ruling on that or something.
I mean, Your Honor, this is a man with limited education. He does not speak English. He was confronted with a form, which I would note also he refused to sign.
I think Rendell's asked you about the form that was like the language above the signature of the agent. That says having considered the substantial evidence. Mm-hmm. Judge Rendell's simply pointing out, I believe, that's just boilerplate language too. And the court asked both sides for what's your position on the status of this motion. And what we didn't get back is we think it's been resolved, if so facto, because there was a second reinstatement order.
Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that the court can consider that second motion as considered on the complete record before ICE, which is what the form says.
The motion to reopen that was opposed. We don't. Maybe we remanded to find out whether there were proceedings and what was the thought process behind the denial, I guess, of the motion to reopen, if that's what it was.
I think that second motion can clearly represents a constructive denial of what we were asking ICE to do. We placed a body of evidence into the record before ICE. We asked them to consider it, and then they, after the fact, issued that second order.
Do you have any other explanation why there was a second order? I know this is really your adversary's question.
I have none, Your Honor. We don't understand why those two orders were issued. And on the first administrative record in this case, it was only the second order was included. It wasn't until the second administrative order in our second PFR where both orders included. And
Your second petition for review to our court doesn't have the second order. It doesn't even reference it.
Yeah.
So it's not there.
Yeah.
I don't know if that has a jurisdictional problem or maybe not.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't understand why those two orders were issued and in the orders that they were. But I do think that we can hang our hat on the fact that they had our material in the record, such as we could develop it, and then they execute a second order.
So that chain of events satisfies, from your point of view, at least exhaustion. And perhaps you would like us to think that the order, that it was decided?
Yes, Your Honor.
For purposes of your suspension clause.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. And again, also, Your Honor, I mean, I think this also points to a sort of, you know, a larger problem that we're having here, is that because of the procedural posture of this case, because he came in through the reinstatement process, and because the constitutional violations we are complaining of happened long after he was ever before an immigration judge, he was before a tribunal that could...
Do you mean long before? The violations happened long before?
Long after, Your Honor. I'm saying the constitutional violation in the stop was recent, and his past removal order, which is the last time he was in front of the judge, was many years in the past.
The 2005 order, but that's not an order before us to review.
No, indeed. My only point, though, Your Honor, is that what happened that night during that traffic stop has not been properly tested, and that's what raises constitutional issues here. And that because, you know, jurisdictionally, you know, we had to come right before this court, you know, we have not had that, you know, that opportunity to really test these issues. And again, this court's recent decision in Osorio Martinez, which I would add we'd be more than happy to provide supplemental briefing on if that would be helpful.
I think we're familiar with that case, and I think the position in that case is someone who's got some established ties here has certain benefits.
I mean, I think it does a little bit more than that, in that Osorio Martinez dealt with arriving aliens. It dealt with a comparable regulatory and statutory regime, sort of, you know, bypassing most habeas protections, but actually providing a little bit more than our client got. So unless we can sort of, I think, show a way to a tribunal that, again, can, you know, make factual decisions, can do discovery, can do all of the things that we expect the habeas court to do in those circumstances, then there's going to be the suspension clause violation. And if Your Honor don't mind, I could talk briefly about sort of our thoughts in that direction.
Well, you want us to go to send it to a district court, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But I think that there's a statutory way to do that, which might avoid a suspension clause violation. And that's just under 2347 of Title 28, actually. So this was, as I recently learned, is referred to as the Hobbs Act when it was first passed in the 1960s. Justice Ginsburg, in a concurring opinion from 1999, wrote, I think, a rather helpful footnote, which the Hobbs Act authorizes a reviewing court of appeals to transfer the proceedings to a district court for resolution of material facts when the agency has not held a hearing, and a hearing is not required by law. Sensitive to the constitutional concerns that would be presented by complete preclusion of judicial review, the Attorney General argues that Section 2347b3 on its face permits transfer to a district court in an appropriate case for resolution of substantial selective enforcement challenges of a final order of deportation. So Reno, this is from Reno versus American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, and this case gets a little murky because of the various sort of jurisdiction stripping changes that have happened over the years, from, you know, the 96 changes, IRA-IRA and ADPA, and then the Real ID Act in 2005. But I think the gravamen of that case was that the petitioners were trying to peremptorily challenge within district court the removal proceedings against them, and they were raising these theories that there was selective prosecution, you know, because of both their religious beliefs and of their ethnicity. So they're raising these constitutional claims. Justice Scalia, when he offered the majority opinion in that case, you know, found that there was clear jurisdiction stripping to actually preclude a removal proceeding in 8 U.S.C. 1252G. However, what I think Justice Ginsburg is sort of informing us is that, you know, at the end of those removal proceedings, of course, one would still have recourse in a court of appeals. And what Justice Ginsburg is reminding us that under the 2347B mechanism, there is still a way for a court of appeals to get these factual records satisfactorily developed in a court below. And I've, you know, obviously did some more looking to see if some other circuit courts have taken this on. I did find one case in the Ninth Circuit, Morgan v. Gonzalez, where again, I mean, these tend to be fairly rare circumstances generally, but the Ninth Circuit in that case found that where the petitioner was again trying to challenge removal based on theories of equitable estoppel and substantive due process, basically he thought, this petitioner thought he had made a deal with, I believe it was the Drug Enforcement Agency, that he would be a cooperating witness some 20 years in the past in exchange for not being placed in deportation proceedings. Many years later, when he is in fact placed in proceedings, he tries to raise these sort of extra INA kind of remedies to his removal, so outside of obviously the immigration law. So in that case, the court actually looked and said, well, should we send it down on 2347B3 grounds, you know, yes or no? And they actually borrowed a little bit from the habeas statute and said, well, is there a colorable claim of a constitutional violation? So they said in that case they found no, you know, simply because he could provide absolutely no evidence that there had ever been, you know, an understanding with government prosecutors and that sort of long-distant proceeding. But they did at least sort of go through the exercise that Justice Ginsburg had suggested in her concurring opinion.
All right. Counsel, thank you for your argument.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Okay.
Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. Brianna Stripley on behalf of the respondent, the Attorney General. I'd like to start by clarifying some points that I think the Court has some questions on. First and foremost, the reason why the second notice of intent decision was because there was an old A numbers were listed on it. So if you see the difference between the two forms is that it was an updated A number. So this is a case where the petitioner has illegally entered the United States eight times, has been removed eight times and has illegally reentered nine times, each under a different alias. So many different A numbers have been issued. When petitioner filed his application for the T1 beneficiary, with USCIS, usually fingerprints are done there. The USCIS was able to find and kind of unify this whole thing back in 2016, and they generated it under the name he submitted, which is the name that he now says is his real name, the Rene. I believe it's Lo. There's so many. I'm going to take a second here and figure it out. The Rene name that he's using. So basically that was what ended up generating this new A number. And to make sure that all of them fell together and you had all these aliases, that's why DHS issued the second one. The only change was basically that
so difference
result, on that.
From your point of view, based upon that description, the second reinstatement order cannot be construed as a disposition of that motion to reopen. Therefore, the motion to reopen must be still pending. Why didn't the government ask us to send it back to get that resolved?
So I think there's a little bit of an ambiguity as to the timeline. So the petitioner submitted the motion to reopen on May 25th, and then the second notice of intent decision was issued on June 8th. You know, notably, petitioner included the wrong A number on the motion to reopen. And that's a big identifier, right? A numbers are basically like social security numbers for aliens. It's how we identify them. And it wasn't just, you know, a number off. There was a completely incorrect. So there's some ambiguity whether the DHS officers had the correct motion to reopen at the time the June 8th order was issued. Petitioners do say in the response to the court's order asking about the status of the motion to reopen that ICE notified them about the error in the alien's number so that they were able to correct it, but didn't provide a time.
You filed an objection to the motion to reopen, taking the position that he waived on that night, so too bad.
Well, yes, Your Honor, because so the motion to reopen, we don't know if that was considered as part of the second order.
I'm saying, and you never got a ruling, did you, on the motion to reopen?
That's correct. The motion to reopen, we believe, is a separate motion that's still pending with DHS. Okay. And so,
was there an objection to that motion? Or we have in front of us a motion to supplement our record to include the motion to reopen, which you have opposed, the government's opposed.
Correct.
Going back to the May 2017, was there an objection? Did the government object to that motion to reopen? I don't know that you would have, because it's not really it's not that kind of proceeding. So as far as if I understand how the process works, there's a motion to reopen that was filed in May of 2017 that has not been resolved, and there has been no opposition to.
you know, the motions to reopen will be up for DHS to decide. I'm not sure that the Attorney General and the Department of Justice would weigh in on those. That's up to their inherent authority to decide, and we don't take a position on that. What we are more concerned about is the fact that we're looking at judicial review and exhaustion in the process. And so in this case, exhaustion is required. Petitioner doesn't contest that. Petitioner's only response is basically that he did contest, and it was through the motion to reopen. But on this record, it's not clear that that's the case, because we don't know if they submitted it in time.
But your contention is it not, that by failing to check the box the night of his arrest, he waived all his rights.
When you do not contest, you do not have an ability to raise other later claims, in this case suppression, later on. And so while they issued the second order, you know, presumably it wouldn't just be the May 9th. Because they reissued it, he would have had a second bite at the apple when they reissued the June 8th, the second notice of intent, right? And when that's the one that's binding now. That's the one that's relevant, is the June 8th.
But we don't know that he was present when that was issued, do we?
The
8 CFR 241.8 says, if an officer determines an alien is subject to removal under this section, he or she shall provide the alien with written notice of his or her determination. The officer shall advise the alien he or she may make a written or oral statement contesting the determination. If the alien wishes to make such a statement, the officer shall allow the alien to do so and shall consider whether the alien's statement warrants reconsideration of the determination. So I'm assuming that you're saying, well, that really happened the night of his arrest.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming you're not contending that that happened on June 8th.
Well, yeah, each time that this order is issued, the regs, to the extent that they have to offer and ask the alien, do you wish to contest, I would presume with regularity that any time you issue an order, you would have to do that on June 8th as well.
But if it happened on June 8th, we know on May 25th, yeah, he filed a motion saying, I want to have this all reconsidered.
That's correct, but we don't know if that motion was forwarded to the same people adjudicating the June 8th motion in time. We don't.
You say in time. Wait a second. A motion to reopen has got to be filed within 30 days, right?
So
it was certainly filed within 30 days of the April 20th.
There is actually no timeline because the basis in which petitioner asserts that their motions to reopen to DHS are guided, the 103.5, only applies to immigration benefits, not reinstatement. There are no regulatory or statutory provisions guiding motions to reopen. However, DHS has inherent authority to always reconsider its reinstatement orders.
Your position is that 8 CFR 103.5 does not apply to the process in which Mr. Lopez went through.
Correct.
It does. Tell us how we would know that. Because this regulation says motion to reopen reconsidered in other than special agricultural worker and legalization cases. And then it has subsections that deal with those special cases.
If you look at to what section it is, it only applies to basically benefits instead of the reinstatement provisions.
Let me just direct my attention to how would I know that?
Oh, I believe it's again, this is something that wasn't briefed, and so I'm kind of happy to submit extra information on this. But this is a purview for DHS to determine its own jurisdiction on the motion to reopen. We're not contesting it right now. There's nothing before this court that the motion to reopen is, right? That's a decision that DHS has to render, and then they PFR, and then the motion to reopen comes before this court.
This provision, though, in 103.5 talks about motions by service officers. They're able to do it on their own motion. Why would we not construe this as giving the same benefit to a petitioner who is subject to a service action?
I would direct the court to a Tenth Circuit case where they, and I can follow a 28-J with the court with the information, but it's basically held that it only applies to the benefits as opposed to...
Oh, let's assume that's the case. You said that the DHS officer, nonetheless, would have the discretion to reopen if it chose. Mr. Lopez's counsel filed an application. There's been no ruling on it. Why don't we just send this back to have that adjudicated?
Again, it's very akin, if you would, to like in the removal proceedings where this court can decide the issue before. It's teed up. The motion to reopen is separate, and that he will have judicial review of, but it has not ripened yet. A decision hasn't been rendered on the motion to reopen. So before this court, we can now look at whether or not his prior order of removal is valid, whether it was proper for DHS to reinstate that prior order. So, you know, the first thing is a threshold issue of exhaustion. Do you have jurisdiction?
Exhaustion. You're going to say that the night that he was arrested, when he didn't check off the box, that he's waived his rights? Are you going to contend that?
It's not a waiver of rights. It's a failure to exhaust, right? You allow an opportunity to contest. You choose not to contest, and then you want to – basically what he ends up doing is raising a suppression motion in the first instance.
He didn't choose either way.
On the second one, it didn't denote that he checked one way or the other.
I have nothing before me that says that that second form – I can't find it right here in the record, but does it have his signature on it?
It has writing on it that says refuse to sign,
yes.
And the handwriting on that is different than the one that's on April 26th, which
right,
also says
correct.
Refuse to sign.
There's different officers for each one that were – that executed
right.
Different ones.
But is your position – I think this is a Judge Rendell's –
And where was he – I mean, he was taken in on that date, and obviously they sat with him in front of there.
I don't know that anybody
just didn't write that in there at some point. I mean, did they really go find him? And he's in jail somewhere,
well,
right?
Yes, he's detained. So you know, and ERO, which is the same subsection of ICE that deals with issuing these orders.
But
I don't know that he refused to sign,
quite frankly. I don't know that that's...
Well, again, the regulation contemplates... Well, the actual field manual for ERO tells them that when the alien refuses to sign that they're supposed to write that in the notation. But if we were to allow any time an alien refuses to sign, prevent the enforcement of it, that would nullify, that would just be a way out for everything.
I don't think that's what we're saying. We're talking simply about whether this refusal to sign constitute a waiver of the ability to raise any challenge to the reinstatement. And is that your position?
By way of a motion to reopen the proceeding. And if that is the case, then the suspension clause issue is right before us.
Well, the suspension clause issue, if you want just generally to turn to, you know, this court, one, there's a forum before the administrative agency where they do have the opportunity to contest the grounds on which they're going to reinstate the order. If they want, they're allowed to submit evidence. They can make a written
Where is
oral.
This provided for, submitting evidence? Is this via motion to reopen?
So in no. If for example, in Ponte Garcia, they actually had evidence that was submitted. So that's, you know, evidence that this is kind of taken. If the alien has some, it has to be considered as part of the contest.
But this provision says he can make a statement.
Right.
The officer can allow the alien to make a statement.
We're really dealing with some regulations that are quite bare bones. But if we look to the field manual, it says that any evidence that petitioner submits has to be included and considered and included in the record of proceedings that officer then prepares. That record of proceeding then gets reviewed by the supervisor who signs below.
Well, that should be somewhere in, you know, on the form, say, and if you want to do this, you have a right to do this. You have a right to produce evidence or something.
Well, the form does inform them of their rights to contest whether
written
or orally.
You don't want to contest.
Right, but I believe the form does inform them of their rights, both through the regulation of everything that's possible. And then on top of that, it's explained to them, made sure it's explained to them in their native language. And so there are, you know, the regulations are...
You do not have a right to a hearing before an immigration judge.
That's correct, because it's a... But it
you can make a statement. You do not have a right to a hearing.
Because, again, you know, in reinstatement cases, there's already been a removal. They've already gotten a lot of due process. You only have to prove the three elements of reinstatement here.
But the situation changes if there has been a Fourth Amendment violation.
Yes, but if there is a Fourth Amendment violation, we're not requiring the alien to come in and make a full suppression motion.
Well,
they just have to alert.
Where does he get the opportunity to do that?
Well, so this is how this would generally play out, is he would alert. He has to, at a minimum, based off of 1252D1, alert the ICE officer that there's been an issue, whether that's
well,
ICE unlawfully
attracted. He's not a lawyer. He's being hauled in. Do you want to contest the determination? And he refuses, you know, he's not going to sign it because also doesn't speak English.
Well, again, it's read to him in his native language. Proceedings are done in whatever language they speak best. But to your point about, yes, it's on, you know, the alien may not be represented, but he has to just at least say something to the extent of, you know, I was unlawfully arrested, or I shouldn't have been arrested, or my pale light was, you know, whatever the claim is. Enough, and just enough to trigger to the agency.
How do we know he didn't say any of that? How do we know he didn't say any of that prior to the reinstatement order?
Because there's no written or, in this case, anything memorialized that he did contest it. And that would have to go in the record of proceedings that DHS prepares. So if that's enough, here's what DHS can do. If there's a Fourth Amendment issue that comes up, and let's say it's bare bones, but they flag it, DHS has several options. They can rescind if it's a, you know, it would be rare, but it's possible. They could transfer to a 240 proceedings if they think that an IJ or, you know, the board should get a more fulsome hearing. Or they could say we look at it and we go forward. Then this court, assuming that we go forward with the reinstatement order, gets full judicial review of it.
Not so just doesn't it make some sense then? We have a circumstance where on April 26th he stopped, reinstatement order is entered, where he refuses to sign. Unclear whether he made any mention about the circumstances of arrest at that time. We know maybe May 4th he makes a comment, or maybe subsequent to that, about the circumstances of the stop. But we know on May 23rd his counsel submits an affidavit to the deciding officers.
May 25th, I believe.
May 25th, thank you, counsel. To the deciding officers that, hey, there was a problem with this stop.
We don't know if it went to the deciding officers. That's what I'm just saying.
No, it got submitted to the agency.
It was submitted to the agency.
Okay,
yes.
Then, okay, it got submitted to the agency. So less than 30 days after, assuming your CFR provision doesn't apply, he presented this matter. Why shouldn't we send it back to let the deciding officer who made a decision in that proceeding, in the reinstatement proceeding, determine all the things you just mentioned, including whether there should be a remedy?
Well, again, the motion to reopen is pending, so they can get this second
so
look at it.
Remand,
I guess the question...
Dismiss this as premature because they have.
This is its own independent proceeding that the court can evaluate. Now, if the court is asking, should it hold this case in abeyance to wait for the second case, which would be the motion to reopen, and then consolidate the two per the statute, which requires it?
But that motion was filed in 2017. There's been no action on it. Wouldn't it be a little helpful if we facilitate that process by saying, you know,
do something.
Deny the petition right now, dismiss the petition, but have that action. Because in your brief, as I read to your adversary, there is a forum to be heard. You don't tell us what your authority is for that, but I'm going to accept it. It came from the government, that the agency could consider the evidence, weigh it, and you just told us some of the remedies. So does it make more sense to let the expertise of the agency evaluate the circumstances that brought the alien to them, and then what the remedy should be?
I guess I would just say that the distinguishing factor in this case is, if you already have a notice of appeal, and our contention is that he failed to exhaust and contest it, and so, you know, as you admit, there is a forum. If you don't take advantage of that, you don't get jurisdiction in the first place, so it would be futile to keep carrying the case, this portion. And he still has judicial review on the motion to reopen when it is adjudicated. So he's not getting precluded
from any
relief. But
really, under your theory,
the
motion to reopen is moot because he failed to exhaust and he waived. That would be your theory, isn't it?
For this case, it would be that he failed to exhaust it, so the court doesn't have jurisdiction to it.
So you're saying that it's still pending is a little bit, your position really is it's out in space and it's moot because he waived and failed to exhaust.
I'm not sure I completely
understand
what's
out in space. You're saying two things. You're saying he failed to exhaust by not contesting on either of those notice to reinstate forms, right? So by doing that, he's out of luck.
Per 8 U.S.C. 1252-D1, yes.
Okay. Then you say, well, the motion to reopen is pending, and we await the proceedings on that. But aren't you saying they're going to be thrown out at some point because he failed to exhaust, and this 103.5 doesn't apply?
I don't know if DHS would necessarily impute the exhaustion to the motion to reopen, for example.
Okay,
what
okay.
If they, you know, if it's a legitimate suppression claim.
Are you representing, I guess I'm confused. You're representing DHS.
Yes, but I can't speculate as to how they will adjudicate the motion to reopen, on what basis they would, and I don't necessarily know whether the 1252...
And you can't state in their position here that it's moot because he failed to exhaust.
I just don't know, and I would hate to represent that position and it not be correct. And because the decision hasn't been rendered, it would just be premature on my part to speculate. But what I can say is that the exhaustion argument is germane to this particular case, and the 1252 is the, you know, it's the Court of Appeals jurisdictions for a petition for review. How that applies to an administrative agency's motion to reopen is unclear.
So really, though, to make sure that he doesn't get, you know, side-swiped, if you will, we need to decide whether that his failure to contest on that form constituted a waiver or an exhaustion.
This court needs to evaluate whether or not it, you know, he did exhaust, right? And what the court, you know, if the court found that that motion to reopen, that there's enough record evidence that it was filed in time and that it was considered, in time meaning, so on May 25th is when they filed the motion. The second one that we're going by for the notice of intent decision is June 8th. What I am representing to the court is the record just simply doesn't say, because of the error on the alien number and petitioner's representation, that ICE had to contact him to figure out. I don't know if that was before the right adjudicatory body by June 8th. So I don't know if that, you know, the record is just simply unclear whether that's before the DHS agent on that time.
What's your best argument that his refusal to sign this form constitutes a knowing waiver of all his rights?
So on the first form, on the first form where he checks the box, I do not contest. There was an affirmative ability on his part after he was read, you know, that he had the right to do so and that it would be considered. He opted not to. Now, you know, I think this is really important just to take a step back.
He opted not to? Or
he affirmatively checked not to contest, so he affirmatively chose not to contest. Drawing one step back just to, like, where we are in these proceedings, you know, these are Congress's intended reinstatement to be streamlined. So for any of the court's concerns about this being more of a bare-bones process, we have to keep it under that umbrella. You know, this is an alien who has been removed multiple times. He's had 240 proceedings twice. So really the scope of these is very narrow. But they are afforded an opportunity to contest. He chose not to in the first form. I will admit the second form is less helpful because no box was checked. But that is the process that the statutory regime that Congress laid out. These regulations have been blessed by this court in Puente Garcia as being sufficient due process. And so because we went through that and he chose not to contest, that constitutes exhaustion under 1252D1. I would just say that, you know, if this court finds that that motion to reopen was properly in the record, then it should be in the record, and what they submitted on the supplemental could be considered to the court. So the court could find there's a duty to exhaust. He did exhaust and then reach the merits. That's one possibility. We would politely disagree with that. But
how could we reach the merits of the Fourth Amendment claim without a factual record? How could we reach the merits of the Fourth Amendment claim without a factual record?
Right. So that would be, if you found exhaustion then because of the motion to reopen, then the motion to reopen presumably would be part of the administrative record.
But all we would have is the motion to reopen, and we'd have an affidavit, but we don't have a fact-finding by anybody. We're a reviewing court.
Yeah.
We don't do that anymore.
You know, in much like you did in Puente Garcia, was to send it back when there was questions about whether they comply with the reinstatement. If that was the case, the court can do so here.
What happens if we, and this will be my last question, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues, what happens if the court were to find an egregious violation, no attenuation, hypothetically, if we were to make that finding? Right? And what's the remedy that could be obtained by the petitioner?
So I would just point that, you know, even if egregious, I think the case law is still unclear about whether or not identity can ever be suppressed.
This is not identity. This is fingerprints evidence. And fingerprints evidence was the fruit of I mean, the source of the whole thing, is it not?
That was what petitioner's representation was. The record's just simply unclear. Now, what's very possible is that the name, which is considered identity, and we briefed this in our case, is enough to run through the system to trigger. And because the name has, you know, had been linked previously, because the T1 beneficiary application was 2016, was arrested and happened until 2017, when he gave his Mexican passport with his real name, that was able to generate.
That could be also part of the record that's made below, exactly what would lead to what as part of the whole Fourth Amendment violation. Should we send it to the district court, like counsel suggests, that perhaps we go to a federal fact finder?
So we would not disagree that for the purposes of suspension clause analysis, that safety valve exists under that provision, under B, but it shouldn't be applicable here. And the reason is the standard on that is that it has to be a genuine issue of material fact. So if you do get to consider affidavits and pleadings of the party. So even if we were just to consider petitioner's extra record evidence now in a light most favorable to them, so accept it all as true, petitioner hasn't demonstrated egregious violations, so there would be no point to transfer the case. But it exists in case the court is concerned about
that. How about a traffic stop has been found? I mean, that could be egregious. I mean, he was handcuffed and arrested because he crossed over a line or arguably had a taillight. Is that the norm? Have someone to take them in and arrest them?
Well, again, the record, part of it is the record is a little bit
bare bones. I think the egregiousness could also be challenged during the hearing as to exactly what happened here.
You mean if this was in the transfer context, or are you talking about
the board DHS? No, I mean as part of the district court proceedings.
So yes, judge is talking about the transfer.
Yes,
transfer to the district court.
Yes, okay, so... Right, but under the actual transfer statute, this court has to make a determination on that first before it sees whether or not it's
available. And what's the determination?
A genuine issue of material fact. And so,
what about a general state of confusion about what happened?
it's a problematic case just because we have a limited record, which is a product of reinstatement, but is so because it's supposed to be a streamline. But there are obviously added issues in this case with just the record keeping and some ambiguities.
I still haven't gotten an answer to my question about what happens.
No problem.
What happens if your adversaries, all their arguments are accepted, the evidence comes out the way they say, there was an egregious Fourth Amendment violation, and hypothetically the law was such that there would be suppression of the link to who he is?
Sure.
What happens
in a situation where the identity is suppressed? It's the same thing that we talked about, which is, you know, and contemplated in, Lopez Mendoza, which is you just have this continuing violation.
All right, and so physically what happens? From a technical point of view, hypothetically, a court would grant the petition. It goes back to the agency. The agency cancels the reinstatement order. Is that correct? And then what happens after that with someone in his status?
Yeah, I have to tell you, I'm not completely sure. Because we don't see this very often, but if the reinstatement order was terminated and he gets released, presumably they could pick him back up for any of the myriad
of
removal orders.
Because the removal order, as Judge Roth was saying to your adversary,
exactly,
remains in effect.
Several of them do. And so, I'm sure there might be litigation about how soon after they could pick and whether or not that's severed and, you know, off of that information. But, yes, at some point, particularly when, petitioner is availing himself in other ways to DHS, this seems like it would just be in an inevitable same situation.
Understand. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for answering our questions for your argument.
Yeah, thank you.
And we'll hear the petitioner back on rebuttal.
Your Honors, respectfully, we are wading through genuine issues of material fact in this case, and that's why I just want to reiterate the importance of access to a tribunal that is capable of really doing fact-finding. A remand to ICE simply sort of places us back where we were over a year ago when he was first picked up and this determination was first made.
Your adversary is representing you could get consideration of evidence and weighing against the agent's account. Tell me there's another avenue.
Well, that evidence, Your Honor, has been before the agency for over a year now. We submitted that in May of 2017. And I'd actually just note, and I can submit 28J material on this if it's helpful, that we followed the procedure that the Philadelphia field office has informed the American Immigration Lawyers Association of Philadelphia, how you're supposed to get this material, which is to email it to their mailbox, which is what we did.
We saw your emails.
Okay, good. Thank you, Your Honor. But we were following the procedure as it had been explained to us. We would submit that, we did everything we were supposed to get this material in front of the adjudicating officer. There must be some reasonable time bar to this, too. I mean, they've been sitting on this motion to rescind, which is long, but it's not that long, for over a year at this point without rendering a decision. So what's to keep them from just sitting on it for another year while my client, continues to sit in Cambria County Prison while they continue to consider it? There must be some sort of reasonable end to this decision being made so we can get to the facts of this case. I also wanted to briefly touch on Ponte Garcia. Ponte Garcia, this court did find that, the due process clause was satisfied. There's an important distinction here, though, between many of these other cases and what's before us now, in that in Ponte Garcia there was a complete record of the core legal issue at question. In Ponte Garcia, there were some ambiguities about the man's immigration history, but there had been prior proceedings in that case. So remanding to ICE made more sense. In this particular case, we have, as I stated before, we have actions of a Pennsylvania state trooper, that occurred, many years past the time he was, last before an adjudicator, that need to be explored. Subpoena dashboard cameras of, I'm actually not sure if state troopers are wearing vest cameras. Even the egregiousness question or the widespread question, which are the two prongs that get us access to the suppression remedy in the immigration context, are questions that require factual records and development of fact, which we have not been able to do.
If the government's representation from their brief pans out and the DHS officer can develop a factual record, isn't it just quicker to have them do it because you could get your immigration relief directly if you're successful, which is, as I understand it from your brief, cancellation of the reinstatement order. So it's sort of one-stop shopping instead of going to the district court, having to make findings, unable to opine on anything other than its view about whether there's a Fourth Amendment violation, doesn't really give you your immigration relief, which is what you really are anxious to obtain.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, partly I think just as a practitioner, I think I have a level of skepticism that we would, prevail on this matter before ICE. What the government is, in effect, asserting is that an arrestee must make a Fourth Amendment claim that their constitutional rights were violated, in effect, by their arresting officer. We're saying that the Pennsylvania State Police and ICE were working in, close cooperation in this matter. I don't see how that can comport with due process. And certainly not under the suspension clause. Without access to a tribunal where he can develop a factual record, and even if it comes back before Your Honors and we say, look, we can show that, this stop was based on his race, that the trooper was acting out of no other motivation than to try to get this guy deported without having, reasonable suspicion or probable cause to support either of those decisions.
How could the trooper be acting under a motivation to get this guy deported when he didn't know who he was when he stopped the car?
Your Honor, I think that is sort of exactly the danger here. I would actually maybe urge Your Honors to go back and look at Mississippi versus Davis, which was, the seminal fingerprint suppression case. That was a criminal investigation in, I think it was 1966 in Mississippi, and there was a dragnet of African Americans throughout the city. There were no warrants were ever issued, and people were just hauled in, and fingerprints were collected until they found a match with an employee of the victim of the crime. The defendant's fingerprints were at the scene of the crime. And so in that case, the suppression of the fingerprint evidence was to deter those kinds of dragnet dragnet police tactics. We are seeing that again in sort of the articles we referenced in some of our briefing.
Well, the alleged facts in this case, to me, don't indicate any dragnet-type operation.
Well, again,
there might be a racial profiling operation, but I don't see that the alleged facts indicate any dragnet.
Again, Your Honor, in our briefing, we do refer to ProPublica and Philadelphia Inquirer reporting that identifies this state police barracks as particularly problematic in terms of arresting Hispanics at much higher rates. And some of them, they're able to call in ICE and get removal orders. Of course, we use the Fourth Amendment to protect those of, that population who's getting arrested and, getting harassed by police, and they're U.S. citizens or they're legal permanent residents. That is why we have the suppression remedy in the first place, Your Honor. And again, I would say that, we've been able to sort of gesture in these directions, sort of through our briefing and through our attempt to, in submitting this material to the agency, but without the opportunity to truly develop a record in front of a tribunal, we come here with one arm tied behind our backs, Your Honor.
All right. Well, thank you for your argument.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
We thank all counsel for their well-argued presentation and their briefing, and we'll take this matter under advisement, and we are concluded for this afternoon.